Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, on this first Friday in November. And with me is my mother, Carolyn Kilborn.
Hello. Beautiful day. Beautiful day.
Yeah, it's great to be back in Iowa. I was gone to Texas last week, and Mom handled the show all by herself.
Yes, I did. A very, very good, I thought, good interview. Really?
Well, after 30 years of radio experience, I imagine that she can do this quite well without me.
Well, I don't know about that, but this gentleman was very talkative and interested in what he was talking about. And we talked about Iowa, which I'm a native Iowan, so it was interesting to me, just the whole thing.
Well, speaking of Iowa, I want to announce something that's going on up in Iowa City today that might be of interest to some of our listeners. The University of Iowa is having a Nonfiction Now conference, and many of the events are free and open to the public. For example, this afternoon, writers from the University of Georgia Press are reading at 3:30 p.m. in the Iowa Memorial Union Main Lounge. There's an afternoon of stand-up tragedy and comedy with Jonathan Ames at 4:30 in Shambaugh Auditorium in the Main Library. There's a keynote reading at 8:30 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow morning at 8:45, there's a forum with editors from the New York Times.
Wow.
There's a reading at 10:30 a.m., another one at 5 p.m., and a keynote reading at 8:30 p.m. So if you check out the www.uiowa.edu website, you can probably find more information about this.
Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I'm thinking of trying to get up there myself. Well, speaking of interesting, we have an interesting guest today.
Yes, we do. Extremely interesting.
We have with us Dr. Angelus Arian. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you both?
We're both fine.
Thank you so much for providing this wonderful opportunity and doing Writer's Voices.
Well, we've been doing this for a little over a year.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And the authors just get more interesting all the time.
That's true. That's true. Now, Dr. Arian is a cultural anthropologist, an award-winning author, an educator, and a consultant to many organizations and businesses. She lectures and conducts workshops worldwide, bridging cultural anthropology, psychology, and comparative religion. And her work is used in medical, academic, and corporate environments. And, Angelus, wouldn't you say it's also just used by normal people in everyday life?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. When I first started to read the book, I thought, I don't know if I can understand this, but as I got into it, I said, yes, I can understand this because this is about human beings, and I'm a human being.
Absolutely.
The title of your new book is The Second Half of Life, Opening the Eight Gates of Wisdom. So, Angelus, tell us what led you to write this book.
One rather horrific statistic that the United States holds is that we have the largest suicide rate between our teens and our elders than any other society in the world. And so it really prompted my wanting to take a look at aging from a cross-cultural point of view and also looking at the strength in other cultures with intergenerational connection, because being the newest culture on the planet, we haven't engaged our youth in community endeavors or problem-solving endeavors, and we certainly haven't called on the experience and wisdom of our elders. And other cultures of the world work more intergenerationally than we do. And, for example, in Asian cultures, their elders are called living treasures. In the indigenous peoples of North and South and Central America refer to their elders as wisdom keepers. Africans in Africa call their elders lodge pole stewards, which is being holding up the community and actively participating. So I was very interested in taking a look at aging from a cross-cultural point of view and seeing what are the universals around aging, and especially after the age of 50, what constitutes moving into our wisdom years. Cross-culturally, we see youth from the ages of 31 to 35, and midlife is 35 to 50, and then the decades of the 50 as the age of integration, and also the restless decade of divine discontent. But then our wisdom years officially start in our 60s, which is considered the youth of our wisdom years, and our 70s, the midlife of our wisdom years, and true eldering is from 80 years of age to 100. So it took me on quite a little adventure. So I really enjoyed writing this book and also offering what are the eight gates to wisdom from a cross-cultural point of view.
I'd like to know more about that decade of divine
discontent.
Yes, yeah.
It's the 50s. Well, it's a decade where we integrate the best of youth and the best of midlife, and it's also knowing that we've started the westward side of the mountain, that we're starting, we've reached a peak, and it's also a huge shift takes place in that decade from ambition to meaning, from acquisition to divestiture, from doing to being, from having to service, from being so I-oriented to moving into we, and serving the greater good. So it's a big, huge shift, and with increased longevity, the second half of life is less marked than the third half of life, and from 50 to the end of our life, and it's an exciting time because we all know our first act, we all know our second act, but the third act is really just like a book or like a play, where we have an opportunity to creatively bring the novel or the journey to a great resolution, whether it's going to be a comedy, a history, or a tragedy. And unfortunately, in our culture, we often, in our 50s, say, oh, I don't have anything more to look forward to except decline, disease, despair, or death, and death, because we know that we can count on two things for sure, our death.
Yeah, right.
we know it's going to come eventually, we just don't know when and how, and we can count on change, that things are always changing, but those are the only two things that we can really count on. And so the decade of the 50s is a time that people really begin to experience a retrospective and also move to recapturing maybe dreams that have been put on the back burner and dreams that have become advocations rather than vocations. And what's really true in the second half of life is that we really won't engage unless it is meaningful, unless it has heart, unless it is something that we deeply value. So there's a huge shift from ambition to meaning in particular.
Now, why do you think that our culture, the position of elders is not as high.
It's diminished.
Yeah, it's diminished. What happened?
Well, it's a youth oriented culture, and it's also an ageist culture. Wisdom, there are many people in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s who demonstrate wisdom. Wisdom is not associated to a certain age, but after we're 50, and we're not demonstrating some kind of wisdom, it's less than becoming. but I think also we also have the highest rate of Alzheimer's than any other culture in the world. And I think there's probably a reason for that. If we don't want to be a burden and if we don't feel needed, there's another place where we can go where we won't be burdened and we won't be needed. We're also the only culture that really puts our elders in waiting stations or separated out from
the
others,
family.
And also one thing that elders of the world, you know, the rest of the world, is that they're still very much engaged. We were the first country also to have required retirement, which in other countries of the world we don't have retired requirements.
I wonder how that came about. People are
able to do what they love as long as they want to do it. And so I think those have been some real contributing factors.
Do you know how mandatory retirement came about?
It was legislated in the, I think, early 50s. In the 1950s, and it came about because there were so many people in the workforce and not enough people for new workers to come in initially. And then Maggie Kuhn was the first to say who really started the Gray Panther movement of getting that reversed, that it wouldn't have to be mandatory, that it could be as a matter of choice. But it's also tied up with the social security issues.
Right, right. Now, Angela, in your book you use these gates of wisdom as kind of your controlling metaphor.
Right.
And why did you choose that, and how did that affect the writing process of this book?
Basically, I took a look at the fairy tales around the world to see what are the tasks of youth and midlife and of our elder years. And Alan Chenin, who is a psychiatrist and also a storyteller at the University of California, he was the first one that really took a look at what were all the tales of youth from a cross-cultural point of view, and what were all the tales of midlife, and what were all the elder tales, and his collections. Then he goes through them according to tasks, and his tales of youth are called Once Upon a Time, and his tales of midlife are called Once Upon a Midlife, and the tales from around the world on eldering or aging is called In the Ever After. And what he found is that, and also Jane Yoam, who has a collection of tales from around the world, she calls Gray Heroes, and it's an excellent anthology as well. And in taking a look at these from a cross-cultural point of view, there were eight gates that keep coming up, or eight tasks that we have to keep aware of or to go through. And so the gates themselves are metaphors for actual tasks. And the tasks of eldership is besides mentoring or midlifers and youth and the principle of generativity, is to really re-enchant the world, which is really the heart of grandfather medicine and grandmother medicine as well. So basically the eight gates the Silver Gate is like facing new experiences and the unknown. And all of these gates we've experienced during our life at different times. But in the second half of life, we're required to go through all of these gates before we leave and not have favorite gates and ones that we don't like, but to really go through all of them. So the one phrase that's used in fairy tales of elder tales is that we all come through the Silver Gate and we all go through the Gold Gate and we all go out the Gold Gate, and there are many gates in between. So the Silver Gate is anything that's new or when we were born or any new experiences or interests or how we handle the unfamiliar or the unknown. And the Gold Gate is practices in non-attachment and surrender and letting go.
And, of course, death then, is the final manifestation
the final
of that. Yes.
But we practice that every time we finish or complete a project or that we say goodbye or we put ourselves in bed every night and we let go and we trust that we'll come back the next morning. Those are all practices in non-attachment or letting go. Or
now, were you the first to identify and name these eight gates, you know, that you found in these different traditions?
Yes.
And how is that something that happened over a period of time?
Well, it happened in reading all of the elder tales from around the world, which were the most prominent tasks or gates that came up, and then what were the metaphors that were used around these gates, and I just named them.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
We're speaking...
And so, like, the white picket fence gate is about changing identities or discovering one's true face, you know, who am I beyond what I do or beyond my interests or beyond my roles, and changing identities because every culture of the world makes masks, which is a deep recognition that there are times where I shift different identities rather than become attached to any one identity.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Carolyn. Our guest today is Dr. Angelus Arian, author of The Second Half of Life, Opening the Eight Gates of Wisdom. And we're discussing some of these eight gates right now.
And she talks about our body wisdom, which, of course, teaches us our true limits and our boundaries and lets us know when we excel and what our bodies can do and can't do, because there are limitations, of course, when you get older.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the clay gate is really coming back into our natural rhythm, which is nature's rhythm, and nature's rhythm is medium to slow. And so it's really coming into a different kind of self-care where we honor our limits, but we learn how to conserve energy and to pace. And I love that Eduardo Galeano, who is a South American writer, in his book on walking words, he described that our relationship with the body becomes very different in the second half of life. And the body says, you know, I will take care of you and be with you, but you can't treat me like you did in the first half of life.
You have to accept the aging process.
Marathons, and you can't get stressed out, and you have to slow down, and I'll take care of you as long as you'll eat right and exercise and rest. You can't overdrive me anymore in the second half of life. And there are wake-up calls, which usually come in the form of illness or accidents that begin to wake us up for those of us who have overridden our bodies in the first half of life. In the second half of life, the body says, no, you won't do it the same way you did.
You can't get away with it anymore.
And so we come back into nature's rhythm, which is medium to slow. And Eduardo Galeano says in his four-line poem, he says, well, the church that says that the body is a sin, advertising says that the body is a business, science says that the body is a machine, but the body itself says it is a fiesta. So in the
I like that.
Second half of life, we just we discovered the fiesta part of the body in slowing down and coming back into our natural rhythm, which is nature's rhythm, medium to slow.
I found interesting what you said about the Scar Clan, that we know we all belong to the Scar Clan. We have been betrayed, hurt, and disappointed in life.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to rule our lives.
No, absolutely not. And that's the beauty of the also of the black and white gate, which is about relationships, which is the crucible of love and generosity and betrayal and forgiveness work. And that in the third act is that we really attend to mending our lives, or really taking a look at resolving any points of regret or remorse, or beginning to, as Robert Frost says, oh, mend my life, oh, mend my life. So the third act is where we, harvest our journey, but we also take a look at bringing resolution, and that's what's so exciting about what are referred to as the golden years, or what's referred to as being able to bring a conclusion to our journey that is really meaningful.
Dr. Arian, why do you call this issue around relationships the black and white gate?
The black and white gate, it's the only gate that we cannot go through by ourselves. We have to go through with one other person, whether it's a friend or a colleague or a child or an animal that we've loved, because it's a teacher about love. And it's the metaphor of the black and white gate is relationships bring out the very best in us or the very worst in us, our light side as well as our shadow sides.
Ah.
it's what the spiritual traditions of the world say, that the most rigorous spiritual practice is the art and craft of relationship. Relationship teaches us so much about love and what we're learning about love and what we know about love and where we close our hearts to love and all the arms of love, gratitude, validation, acknowledgement, recognition, joy, laughter, forgiveness work.
Okay, so then the next gate has to do with creativity, service, and generativity.
Yes, the rustic gate, and it's really about work, our contribution, human beings. The black and white gate teaches us about love, and the rustic gate teaches us about our calling or our purpose or our contribution in the world. And it's a task in the third act of life where we move either from creativity and work to service and generativity, or we really realize that maybe in the first half of life I was very successful, but I turned out not to be a very nice person, even though I was successful. Second half of life really is about coming into our deep personhood and aligning it with our work and our contribution.
And Dr. Arian, what do you exactly mean by generativity?
Generativity is the ability to, comes from the word generate, to give back, to create openings for possibilities for others.
That seems
so
to be...
So it's like mentoring as well.
Okay.
Helping others along the road.
So it's sort of a combination of generating and helping the next generation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's very well said.
You know, I hear a lot, of course, I am obviously at 72 in the last part of my life, and I hear a lot of my contemporaries say that these years are not so golden, and I don't know what they were expecting. And, of course, I know some of it has to do with health issues.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's very obvious, you know.
Yeah.
And some people, of course, who have health issues can't think of anything else because that dominates their life, and I can understand that.
Right, absolutely.
But it's too bad.
And I think it's very interesting because many traditional peoples of the world hold illness as an initiation, as a way of strengthening oneself. And illness requires courage and vulnerability and openness, and it serves to reprioritize what's really important. So it's not an easy trial, but it's really one of our first brushes with death and really initiating us into what's really important or meaningful for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard passage, and yet those who go into remission with some chronic illnesses always report that they came out as stronger or better people.
Yeah, it's like none of us want to have to go through that,
but it's like interesting that Albert Schweitzer said, you know, many people really don't fear death, but what they do fear is pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think illness begins to prepare us for that.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Carolyn, and our guest today is Dr. Angelus Arian. We're discussing her most recent work, The Second Half of Life, Opening the Eight Gates of Wisdom. Of course, I said sacred there by mistake, except there is a lot in this that's sacred.
Yeah, second half of life, we also go into exploring our trust and faith and a lot of our own authenticity and wisdom and character development. It's the place where we really let go of the false self, any place where we've pretended or have stubborn places of an unhealthy pride or the need to look good or have it together or be right or do it right. So at the bone gate, it's like what Gertrude Stein says is that no one real is boring. So they shredded kind of the false affected parts of ourselves or old coping mechanisms.
Is there a point
rather than trusting that who we are is really valuable as we are? I love the adage, you know, I might as well be myself because everyone else is taken.
You know, so I've been wondering, is there a point where
really the place of coming home and deeply befriending oneself, and not in a narcissistic way, but in a way where we feel at home with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a point in time where you get to say exactly what you think and you're so old that people can't criticize you anymore?
Well, I think that what happens is that there's a difference between...
'cause that's what I'm looking forward to.
Yes. You know? there's a freedom and a liberation that takes place, but there's also wisdom never really moves into eccentricity. Eccentricity is probably our way of bringing the rebel into our elder years. But the true liberation comes from being able to say and speak what you really want to say and speak from a place of wisdom rather than from a place of eccentricity, which doesn't carry responsibility. We say things in very hurtful ways in the name of eccentricity rather than just speaking the truth of what's so without blame or judgment, which is not making nice or polite, because that goes away in the third act. Is we can't stand making nice.
Right. You know, your mother...
And social lying is... But we move into a deeper place of truth-telling, which allows other people to look again rather than to move into defense. And that's a very powerful place of wisdom.
You know, the advice that your mother gave you, which was honesty is the best policy.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, sometimes if you're always honest, people don't like to hear the truth.
Yeah, and they don't. And yet, a good friend who can deliver the truth from a place of concern is a really valued friend.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah, and your father taught you to hunt because he thought you needed to know how to protect yourself, right?
Oh, Minnie, it's an example in the book of Minnie Nighthawk. She's 87 years old, and someone asked her why she didn't have wrinkles, because she looked like she was like 53 and she was 87, and she said that her father said that every woman should be able to take care of herself, so he taught her how to fish and to hunt. And then her mother said, and every person, whether they're male or female, should do two things every day. They should eat breakfast every day,
right,
and they should tell the truth every day.
Uh-huh.
She said, that's why I don't have wrinkles. I eat breakfast every day, and I
tell the truth.
I don't have to worry about not telling the truth because I'm just honest. And then she said, and I know how to take care of myself. I know how to fish and hunt. That's a wonderful example from a wonderful anthology, which is called What's Worth Knowing, which is an anthology of interviews for individuals who are 70 to 90 years old, and they were asked the question, what's worth knowing after all of these years? And that was her offering, which I've included in the second half of life.
Oh, that sounds like a really good piece of literature to read.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about the five stages of the soul that you referred to. Can you speak to that? The call, the search, the struggle, the breakthrough, and the return?
Right. These are ways to track our experience. And the five stages of the soul comes from Harry Moody and David Carroll's book called The Five Stages of the Soul, where, and I use it in the second half of life as an example of how either in relationships or in work or in health or finances, you can use these five stages. You know, what are you called to? What is the call of your work? What is that you're searching for in your work at this time, the search, and how does it satisfy you?
Mm-hmm.
The struggle, what is the current workplace struggle, or what are you struggling with at work, and do you see any patterns in your struggle? And then the breakthrough is, which is a stage, and if we apply it to work, what breakthrough do you want to create in your work that would lead to a major advance for the organization in the next 3 months would be a possibility, or what plan of action will you generate to make the breakthrough happen. And then you have also the return after you've been called and after you've searched for what you wanted and work or work through the struggle or the breakthrough. Then there's the return that is to come back to known experiences and to harvest a different result.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to return to that you have found effective in your work? Or how can you apply this effectiveness to a current situation that you're tracking? So there are really five wonderful stages that can be applied to any problem or to any issue or circumstance in your life or any category in your life. The call, the search, the struggle, the breakthrough, and the return.
But you have to be willing to seek these out.
Yes.
And to work through those.
Yes. And to really look at them in a direct way.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Angeles, what is the natural gate?
The natural gate, we've been at the natural gate many times in our lives. It's all the times that we've experienced this, had the experience of contentment and satisfaction. It's a time that we've been happy or sense of grace or a sense of peacefulness or a sense of balance in our lives. I love that Spinoza said if you want to track what's meaningful in your life, just at the end of each day to ask yourself these three questions. What made you happy today? Not who made you happy, but what made you happy, because many people think that it's other people's responsibility to make us happy. It's what made you happy today, because what's essentially true is we are responsible for our own experience of happiness, and if other people make us happy, that's like the frosting to the cake rather than the cake. And then the second question, where did you experience a sense of peace or comfort or balance today? And that question is very important because it shows where we're not striving or pushing or holding back. We're just in a place of contentment or comfort or trust. And the last question, who or what inspired you today?
Mm.
And that's being at the natural gate, is where there's no striving or holding back, and there's the presence of grace or the sense of peace or joy or contentment or solace or happiness.
Dr. Arian, throughout your material, your book, your CD that I listened to, and also just in your speech, you pull in a lot of wisdom from a variety of sources, from written sources, from traditional sources, and you sort of synthesize all of this. What is that process like for you when you decide to tackle a certain subject? Are you drawing on things that you've read and learned over many, many years, or do you go and research that subject then, or a combination? And do you, as you're reading, do you keep notes of things that you might use in some future project? I'd like to know how you gather all this wonderful material.
Well, I'd have to say yes to all of the above. Basically, what's interesting to me about my own writing process is that I'm often, when I'm in one book writing, I often have many ideas of the next book starts coming in. And basically, with the second half of life, is that I've been a cultural anthropologist now for almost 35, close to 40 years, 35 years, and I've been really interested in where are the points of unity in the world, because I really feel that's where we can begin to honor the differences or the rich diversity that's found in the world. And so I do a lot of culling from my own experience as a cultural anthropologist, but I also have access to a lot of resources. Like there's the Human Relations Area File, which is a country and subject index, which logs not only written materials worldwide, but also what's in oral tradition. As an anthropologist, I also went into comparative religions, and so I bring a lot from the spiritual traditions of the world and what they also all have in common. And I've also worked a lot with mythology and fairy tales and legends since Joseph Campbell and Margaret Mead have both been great mentors of mine. So I do work, I have, my writing style is basically I carry a lot of different colored 5x7 cards, and so that yellow are like new ideas or insights that I have that I think should go into the book. Blue are quotes that I think would be relevant from around the world. Red are specific examples or stories. And then green is research that's been done, research examples from around the world. So those are, and then I go through all of those and pick out what would be most appropriate.
So you're collecting these all the time?
Yes, I am all the time. It's my little, what I call the idea trap.
And even, you may be collecting quotes or research results from something that isn't even on nearly the subject that you're writing right now, but you think
totally, just that I find really interesting.
That you find interesting.
Fascinating.
And then how do you index these?
It's so interesting because I've been doing this specifically, the color, what I call my color cards for 20, 25 years.
So you must have a lot of them.
Yeah, so I do.
And how do you find? I mean, how do you organize them so that you can find what you need when you want it?
When you need it.
Well, I have like all my quotes. They're all one color, but I have them by subject.
Okay.
General subjects, you know, like you find often in a quotation book,
right.
Gratitude or
right
peace or
nature,
violence or fear. You know, I have different quotes that might apply to the human condition. And
are each of your different color cards all, you know, each color is organized within itself by these categories?
Yeah, by these categories, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's been very helpful.
Now, have you ever been tempted to computerize your database?
Oh, it would take a long time. I'd have to get an intern to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm just starting on that because I'm more a hands-on writer or a speaking writer. Often I speak a lot also into tape and then have that transcribed and edited as well.
And so you write longhand as well?
Yeah, I do.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, for me, something gets imprinted there that doesn't so much in typing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm also a good typist, and there's something that happens there that doesn't happen in typing or on the computer for me. And you know, it's reversed for other people. But
exactly.
For me, I think it's because I'm more orally and kinesthetically oriented. Want the feeling of it. I can rewrite it. I can scratch it out. And
Dr. Arian, do you have a selection from the second half of life that you'd like to read to our listeners today?
Oh, let's see. Probably just leave everyone with Ralph Waldo Emerson's quote.
Oh, good. I was hoping you'd pick that.
About what is a successful life, to know that you've had, that you have succeeded, that it summarizes so much of the beauty of the third act. He says, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or redeemed social condition. To know even one life has breathed easier because you live, that is to have succeeded. And I think that for everyone in the audience is that I particularly like the last line, to know even one life has breathed easier because you live. I think everyone has at least one life that breathes easier because we've lived, and that is to have succeeded. So thank you so much for this opportunity and for the incredible work both of you are doing, not only modeling mother and daughter in a creative endeavor, but really providing a place for the writer's voice to come forward.
Oh, thank you. We do have a few more minutes, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your publisher. I know that you're published by Sounds True, which is...
Yes, for this book.
For this book.
This book has been published by Sounds True, and Sounds True does an incredible job with tapes, and they've just recently started putting some of the tape work into books, or having the books be an addendum to the tapes.
So originally this material was a tape series.
Yes, it was, and this is just one tape, one side of one tape this book is.
How did you go about transferring from that verbal presentation to the written form?
Basically, I had the tape transcribed just on the eight gates. It was one section on the eight gates out of six tapes. I set a context for the second half of life from a cross-cultural point of view and just surrounding these eight gates and put it into book form. So we transcribed it, and then I did a lot of context setting and bringing it into written form because it's very different. The spoken word is often very different than the written word, so that the reader has an experience. And what's different about this is that I added that each gate also has a gift, and each gate has a task, and each gate has a practice or a reflection to help the reader have an experience of the gate.
So when you created the tape series originally, do you write out what you're going to speak?
I just had an outline that I worked from.
Okay. And then do you do a lot of takes? Or
yes, I do a lot of takes.
And how, it must be.
I do a lot of takes because one of the biggest surprises of my life is really is to have written books, because it was not an initial calling. And basically the books have come out of a lot of my work or a lot of my programs or a lot of my teaching work. And so people say, oh, could we have that in writing, or could you write an article about what you just said, or could you write a book around this whole program, or could you write a book around this tape? And so my writing has really come out of a lot of my oral work.
Well, we're looking at the front cover of your book, or the inside cover, where lists your other works, and it looks like this is your sixth book.
Yes, it's my sixth book, and The Fourfold Way is by HarperCollins, and Signs of Life and the Nine Muses and the Tarot Handbook are by Putnam Tarcher.
And then you have an anthology.
Working Together, which is an anthology, which is by Barrett Kohler.
So you've worked with a number of different publishing companies.
Yes, and I really loved working with Sounds True, and that it was their primary function is tape distribution, but now they're starting to add books as well. So it was wonderful to be a part of that work.
And their focus is on spiritual writing.
Yes.
Is that correct? And that may be different from the other publishers you worked with.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself more comfortable in working with somebody where that's their focus, that maybe they understand your work a little better?
Well, I think what I really enjoyed around Sounds True is that my propensity is more the oral tradition and tapes, and so it was really wonderful to bring that into a direct written form, and also to be able to support, which I think in the third act there's a lot of really coming into more faith and spirituality, and so that was great. But I often weave those themes in anyway in my other books as well, because of my background in comparative religions.
Mm. Now, one final question for you, and that has to do with the photographs that you use in this book.
Oh, the photographs, the hand photographs come from Penny Bauer, who is a wonderful photographer. The rest of the photographs were provided by Sounds True, but basically any of the hand photographs, Penny Bauer is a wonderful photographer, and she did a whole series called In the Hands of Wisdom, or a series called The Gift, and her work is also available on Penny Bauer on the web, and her artwork or her photography. So I really love the compelling photograph of hers that's on the cover, and also the title of each of the chapters, which have the hands.
So for each of the gates of wisdom, you have a hands of wisdom.
Yes. And then the feet, hands and feet are the hands for the human spirit is reaching for certain goals, and also is associated with making or manifesting or crafting, and the feet are for grounding and balance and moving forward or moving away from.
Ah, so that's why you have a photo of feet at the end of each
chapter,
and
yeah,
then the hands going into it. Well, thank you for joining us today. It was a great pleasure, a great privilege to have you here with us.
Oh, my honor. Thank
okay.
you very, very much.
All right.
Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
That was so interesting. The book itself is interesting, and you start and think, okay, I'll put this down, but you can't really put it down. Because each section has wisdom of its own, and for each person, that because each person is going to come to this with their own experience and their own life experience, and they're going to find things of wisdom in it.
That's true. So that was Dr. Angelus Arian with The Second Half of Life, Opening the Eight Gates of Wisdom, and that's available at www.soundstrue.com. And we thank the people at Sounds True for putting her in touch with us for today's interview. Before we close, I want to mention again that the University of Iowa is having this Nonfiction Now conference this weekend, and that there's events today and tomorrow that are free and open to the public. There's a little blurb in the Fairfield Weekly Reader under Iowa City that has the full website for all the details. So you can check that there.
You know, when I tell, because I live in Mount Pleasant, when I tell people, you know, about this program, and I say there's just so much talent in Fairfield, and they're writers and publishers and editors and everything, and next week we're going to have someone that's going to be interesting.
Yes, next week's guest is Jennifer Hawthorne, who has just published another Chicken Soup book. This one is focused on... The title is, it's right on the tip of my tongue, something about learning to love the way you live,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Jennifer's had is a very successful author, and we're really excited to have her on the show.
We've had a number of interesting people, really. It just goes on, and it's delightful to meet them, or if you can't meet them in person, to at least to talk to them and to read their books.
So stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for James Moore, Planet Erstwhile, and I'm not absolutely sure what you'll be hearing next on Monday because they keep changing the schedule.
Well,
they haven't changed it too many times.
It's something.
Wildflower Cafe with Susan Hirschman.
Thank you, James. And we will close with a quote from Mom.
This is, I just love this one. If you can read, you are richly blessed because reading gives us some place to go when we have to stay where we are.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.